content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Happy New Year, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a New Year's Eve story from the January 11th, 1999 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the fiction section, New York Mining Disaster by Haruki Murakami. A friend of mine has a habit of going to the zoo whenever there's a typhoon. He's been doing this for 10 years. At a time when most people are closing their storm shutters or running out to stock up on mineral water or checking to see if their radios and flashlights are working, my friend wraps himself in an army surplus poncho from the Vietnam War, stuffs a couple of cans of beer into his pockets, and sets off. He lives about a 15-minute walk away. If he's lucky, the zoo is closed, owing to inclement weather, and its gates are locked. When this happens, my friend sits down on the stone statue of a squirrel next to the entrance, drinks his lukewarm beer, and then heads back home. But when he makes it there in time, he pays the entrance fee, lights a soggy cigarette, and surveys the animals one by one. Most of them have retreated to their shelters. Some stare blankly at the rain. Others are more animated, jumping around in the gale-force winds. Some are frightened by the sudden drop in barometric pressure. Others turn vicious. My friend makes a point of drinking his first beer in front of the Bengal tiger cage. Bengal tigers always react the most violently to storms. He drinks his second one outside the gorilla cage. Most of the time, the gorillas aren't the least bit disturbed by the typhoon. They stare at him calmly as he sits like a mermaid on the concrete floor, sipping his beer. And you'd swear they actually felt sorry for him. It's like being in an elevator when it breaks down and you're trapped inside with strangers, my friend tells me. Typhoons aside, my friend's no different from anyone else. He works for an export company, managing foreign investments. It's not one of the better firms, but it does well enough. He lives alone in a neat little apartment and gets a new girlfriend every 6 months. Why he insists on having a new one every 6 months, and it's always exactly 6 months, I'll never understand. The girls all look the same, as if they were perfect clones of one another, and I can't tell them apart. My friend owns a nice used car, the collected works of Balzac, and a black suit, a black tie, and black shoes that are perfect for attending funerals. Every time someone dies, I call him and ask if I can borrow them, even though the suit and the shoes are one size too big for me. "Sorry to bother you again," I said the last time I called. "Another funeral's come up." "Well, help yourself. You must be in a hurry," he answered. "Why don't you come over right away?" When I arrived, the suit and tie were laid out on the table, neatly pressed. The shoes were polished, and the fridge was full of cold imported beer. That's the kind of guy he is. "The other day I saw a cat at the zoo," he said, opening a beer. "A cat?" "Yeah, 2 weeks ago I was in Hokkaido on business and dropped by a zoo near my hotel. There was a cat asleep in a cage with a sign that said, 'Cat.'" "Well, what kind of cat?" "Oh, just an ordinary one, brown stripe, short tail, and unbelievably fat. It just plopped down on its side and lay there." "Maybe cats aren't so common in Hokkaido?" "You're kidding, right?" he asked, astonished. "There must be cats in Hokkaido. They can't be that unusual." "Well, look at it another way. Why shouldn't there be cats in a zoo?" I said. "They're animals, too, right?" "Cats and dogs are your run-of-the-mill type animals. Nobody's going to pay money to see them," he said. "Just look around you. They're everywhere. Same thing with people." When we'd finished off a six-pack, I put the suit and tie and shoebox into a large paper bag. "Sorry to keep doing this to you," I said. "I know I should buy my own suit, but somehow I never get around to it. And I feel like if I buy funeral clothes, I'm saying it's okay if somebody dies." "No problem," he said. "I'm not using them anyway. It's better to have someone use them than to have them hanging in the closet, right?" It was true that in the 3 years since he'd had the suit made, he'd hardly worn it. It's weird, but since I got the suit, not a single person I know has died, he explained. Well, that's the way it goes. Yes, that's the way it goes, he said. For me, on the other hand, it was the year of funerals. Friends and former friends died one after another, like ears of corn withering in a drought. I was 28. My friends were all about the same age, 27, 28, 29, not the right age to die. A poet dies at 21, a revolutionary or a rock star at 24. But after that, you assume that everything is going to be all right. You've made it past Dead Man's Curve, and you're out of the tunnel, cruising straight for your destination down a 6-lane highway, whether you want to be or not. You get your hair cut. You shave every morning. You aren't a poet anymore, or a revolutionary, or a rock star. You don't pass out drunk in phone booths, or blast the Doors at 4 in the morning. Instead, you buy life insurance from your friend's company, drink in hotel bars, and keep your dental bills for medical deductions. That's normal at 28. But that was exactly when the unexpected massacre started in our lives. It was like a surprise attack on a lazy spring day. As if someone on top of a metaphysical hill holding a metaphysical machine gun had sprayed us with bullets. One minute we were changing our clothes, and the next minute they didn't fit anymore. The sleeves were inside out, and we had one leg in one pair of pants and the other in a different pair. It was a mess. But death is just that. A rabbit is a rabbit whether it springs out of a hat or a wheat field. A hot oven is a hot oven, and the black smoke rising from a chimney is what it is. Black smoke rising from a chimney. The first person to straddle the divide between reality and unreality, or unreality and reality, was a friend from college who taught English at a junior high school. He'd been married for 3 years, and his wife had gone back to her parents' house in Shikoku to have their baby. One unusually warm Sunday afternoon in January, he went to a department store and bought 2 cans of shaving cream and a German-made knife that was big enough to lop off an elephant's ear. He went home, ran a bath. He got some ice from the refrigerator, downed a bottle of scotch, climbed into the tub, and slit his wrists. His mother found his body 2 days later. The police came and took a lot of photographs. Blood had dyed the bath the color of tomato juice. The police ruled it a suicide. After all, the doors had been locked, and, of course, the deceased had bought the knife himself. But why did he buy 2 cans of shaving cream that he didn't plan to use? No one knew. Maybe it hadn't hit him when he was at the department store that in a couple of hours he'd be dead. Or maybe he was afraid that the cashier would guess that he was going to kill himself. He didn't leave a will or a note. On the kitchen table there was only a glass, the empty whiskey bottle, an ice bowl, and the 2 cans of shaving cream. While he was waiting for the bath to fill, knocking back glass after glass of Hague on the rocks, he must have stared at those cans and thought something along the lines of, "I'll never have to shave again." A man's death at 28 is as sad as the winter rain. During the next 12 months, 4 more people died. One died in March in an incident at an oil field in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, and 2 died in June, a heart attack and a traffic accident. From July to November, there was peace. But then in December, another friend died, also in a car crash. Unlike my first friend, who'd killed himself, these friends never had time to realize that they were dying. For them, it was like climbing up a staircase they'd climbed a million times before and suddenly finding a step missing. "Would you make up the bed for me?" the friend who died of a heart attack had asked his wife. He was a furniture designer. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. He'd woken up at 9, worked for a while in his room, and then said he felt sleepy. He went to the kitchen, made some coffee, and drank it. But the coffee didn't help. "I think I'll take a nap," he said. "I hear a buzzing sound in the back of my head." Those were his last words. He curled up in bed, went to sleep, and never woke up again. The friend who died in December was the youngest and the only woman. She was 24, like a revolutionary or a rock star. One cold, rainy evening, just before Christmas, she was flattened in the tragic yet quite ordinary space between a beer delivery truck and a concrete telephone pole. A few days after the last funeral, I went to my friend's apartment to return the suit, which I'd picked up from the dry cleaners, and to give him a bottle of whiskey to thank him. "Much obliged. You've helped me out once again," I said. As usual, his fridge was full of cold beer, and his comfortable sofa reflected a faint ray of sunlight. On the coffee table, there was a clean ashtray and a pot of Christmas poinsettias. He accepted the suit in its plastic covering, his movements leisurely, like those of a bear just coming out of hibernation, and quietly put it away. "Well, I hope that suit doesn't smell like a funeral," I said. "Clothes aren't important. The real problem is what's inside them." "Ah," I said. "One funeral after another for you this year," he said, stretching out on the sofa and pouring beer into a glass. "How many altogether?" "Five," I said, spreading out the fingers of my left hand. "But I think that's got to be it." "Are you sure?" "Enough people have died." "It's like the curse of the pyramids or something," he said. "I remember reading that somewhere the curse continues until enough people have died. Or else a red star appears in the sky and the moon's shadow covers the sun." After we finished a six-pack, we started on the whiskey. The winter sunlight sloped gently into the room. "You look a little glum these days," he said. "Really?" I said. "You must be thinking about things too much in the middle of the night," he said. "I've stopped thinking about things at night." "How'd you manage that?" "When I get depressed, I start to clean. Even if it's 2 or 3 in the morning, I wash the dishes, mop the floor, bleach the dish towels, organize my desk drawers, iron every shirt in sight," he said, stirring his drink with his finger. "I do that until I'm exhausted, and then I have a drink and go to sleep. In the morning, I get up, and by the time I'm putting on my socks, I can't even remember what it was I was thinking about." I looked around again. As always, the room was clean and orderly. "People think of all kinds of things at 3 in the morning. We all do. That's why we each have to figure out our own way of fighting it off." "Huh, you're probably right," I said. "Even animals think things over at 3 a.m., he said, as if he were remembering something. "Have you ever gone to a zoo at 3 a.m? "No," I said vaguely. "No, of course not." "Well, I've only done it once. A friend of mine works at a zoo, and I asked him to let me in when he had the night shift." "You're not supposed to, really." He shook his glass. "It was a strange experience. I can't explain it, but I felt as if the ground had silently split open and something was crawling up out of it. And then there was this invisible thing on a rampage in the dark. It was as if the cold night air had coagulated. I couldn't see it, but I felt it. And the animals felt it, too. It made me think about the fact that the ground we walk on goes all the way to the Earth's core. And I suddenly realized that the core has sucked up an incredible amount of time." I didn't say anything. "Anyway, I never want to go again to the zoo in the middle of the night. I mean, you prefer a typhoon?" "Yeah," he said, "I'll take a typhoon any day." The phone rang, and he went to his bedroom to take the call. It was his girlfriend, Clone, with an endless clone phone call. I wanted to tell him I was going to call it a day, but he was on the phone forever. I gave up waiting and switched on the TV. It was a 27-inch color set with a remote control, the kind you barely have to touch to change the channel. The TV had 6 speakers and great sound. I'd never seen such a wonderful TV. I made 2 complete rounds of the channels before settling on a news program. A border clash, a fire, exchange rates going up and down, a new limit on car imports, an outdoor winter swim meet, a family suicide. All these bits of news seemed somehow connected, like people in a high school graduation photo. "Any interesting news?" my friend asked as he came back into the room. "Not really," I said. "Do you watch a lot of TV?" I shook my head. "I don't have a TV." "Well, there's at least one good thing about TV," he said after a while. "You can shut it off whenever you like, and nobody complains." He pushed the off button on the remote control. Immediately, the screen went blank. The room was still. Outside the window, lights in other buildings were starting to come on. We sat there for 5 minutes, drinking whiskey, with nothing to talk about. The telephone rang again, but he pretended not to hear it. Just as the phone stopped ringing, he hit the on button, as if he'd suddenly remembered something. The picture returned instantly, and a commentator standing in front of a graph gestured with a pointer as he explained changes in the price of oil. "See? He didn't even notice that we'd switched him off for 5 minutes." "True enough," I said. "Why is that?" It was too much trouble to think it through, so I shook my head. "When you switch it off, one side ceases to exist. It's us or him. You just hit the switch and there's a communications blackout. It's easy." "Well, that's one way of thinking of it," I said. "There are millions of ways of thinking. In India, they grow coconut trees. In Argentina, it rains political prisoners from helicopters." He switched the TV off again. "I don't want to say anything about other people," he said, "but consider the fact that there are ways of dying that don't end in funerals. Types of death you can't smell." I nodded silently. I felt that I knew what he was getting at. At the same time, I felt that I had no idea what he meant. I was tired and a bit confused. I sat there fingering one of the poinsettia's green leaves. "I've got some champagne," he said earnestly. "I brought it back from a business trip to France a while ago. I don't know much about champagne, but this is supposed to be great. Would you like some? Champagne might be just the thing after a string of funerals." He brought out the chilled champagne bottle and two clean glasses and set them quietly on the table and then smiled slyly. "Champagne's completely useless, you know," he said. "The only good part is the moment you pop the cork." "Well, I can't argue with you there," I said. We popped the cork and talked for a while about the zoo in Paris and the animals that lived there. The champagne was excellent. There was a party at the end of the year, an annual New Year's Eve party, at a bar in Roppongi, which had been rented for the occasion. A piano trio played, and there was a lot of good food and drink. When I ran across someone I knew, I'd chat for a while. My job required that I put in an appearance every year. Parties aren't my thing, but this one was easy to take. I had nothing else to do on New Year's Eve and could just stand by myself in a corner, relax, have a drink, and enjoy the music. No obnoxious people, no need to be introduced to strangers and listen to them rant for half an hour about how a vegetarian diet cures cancer. But that evening, someone introduced me to a woman. After the usual small talk, I tried to retreat to my corner again, but the woman followed me back to my seat, whiskey glass in hand. "I asked to be introduced to you," she said amiably. She wasn't the type to turn heads, though she was certainly attractive. She was wearing an expensive green silk dress. I guessed that she was about 32. She could easily have made herself look younger, but she didn't seem to think it was worth the trouble. Three rings graced her fingers, and a faint smile played on her lips. "You look exactly like someone I know," she said. "Your facial features, your back, the way you talk, the overall mood, it's an amazing likeness. I've been watching you ever since you came in." "If he's that much like me, I'd like to meet the guy," I said. I had no idea what else to say. "You would? I'd want to see what it feels like to meet someone who's exactly like me." Her smile deepened for an instant and then softened. "But it's impossible," she said. "He died 5 years ago when he was about the same age you are now. Is that right? I said. I killed him. The trio was just finishing its second set, and there was a smattering of half-hearted applause. Do you like music? She asked me. Well, I do if it's nice music in a nice world. In a nice world, there is no nice music, she said, as if she were telling some vital secret. In a nice world, the air doesn't vibrate. I see, I said, not knowing how to respond. Have you seen the movie where Warren Beatty plays a piano in a nightclub? No, I haven't. Elizabeth Taylor is one of the customers at the club, and she's really poor and miserable. So, Warren Beatty asks Elizabeth Taylor if she has any requests. And does she? I forget, it's a really old movie. Her rings sparkled as she drank her whiskey. I hate requests. They make me feel unhappy. It's like when I take a book out of the library. As soon as I start to read it, all I can think about is when I'll finish it. She put a cigarette between her lips. I struck a match and lit it for her. Let's see, she said. We were talking about the person who looked like you. How did you kill him? I threw him into a beehive. You're kidding, right? Yes, she said. Instead of sighing, I took a sip of whiskey. The ice had melted, and it barely tasted like whiskey anymore. Of course, legally, I'm not a murderer, she said, or morally, either. Neither legally nor morally a murderer. I didn't want to, but I reviewed the point she made. But you did kill someone. Right, she nodded happily. Someone who looked just like you. Across the room, a man let out a loud laugh, and the people around him laughed too. Glasses clinked. It sounded very far away, but extremely clear. I don't know why, but my heart was pounding, as if it were expanding or moving up and down. I felt as if I were walking on earth that was floating on water. It took less than 5 seconds, she said, to kill him. We were silent for a while. She was taking her time, savoring the silence. Do you ever think about freedom? She asked. Sometimes, I said. Why do you ask? Can you draw a daisy? I think so. Is this a personality test? Well, almost, she laughed. Well, did I pass? Yes, she answered. You'll be fine. Nothing to worry about. Intuition tells me you'll live a good, long life. Thank you, I said. The band began playing Auld Lang Syne. 11:55, she said, glancing at the gold watch in her pendant. I really like Auld Lang Syne. How about you? I prefer Home on the Range. All those deer and antelope. She smiled again. You must like animals. I do, I said. And I thought of my friend who liked zoos and of his funeral suit. I enjoyed talking to you. Goodbye. Goodbye, I said. They blew out their lamps to save on air, and darkness surrounded them. No one spoke. All they could hear in the dark was the sound of water dripping from the ceiling every 5 seconds. Okay, everybody, try not to breathe so much. We don't have enough air left, an old miner said. He held his voice to a whisper, but even so the wooden beams on the ceiling of the tunnel creaked faintly. In the dark, the miners huddled together, straining to hear one sound, the sound of pickaxes, the sound of life. They waited for hours. Reality began to melt away in the darkness. Everything began to feel as if it were happening a long time ago, in a world far away. Or was it happening in the future, in a different far-off world? Outside, people were digging a hole, trying to reach them. It was like a scene from a movie. Next, from the New Yorker's 2021 in Review, The Year in Climate, A Summer That Really Scared Scientists, by Bill McKibben. This year, a lot of the things we've come to expect with the climate crisis happened. There were heavy rains. New York City beat its rainfall record twice in 11 days. There was a big global conference, this one in Glasgow, with modest results. the price of renewable energy fell some more, and a record amount of solar power and wind power was produced, but not at a pace fast enough to catch up with climate change. Raging wildfires produced plumes of smoke that spread around the world. President Joe Biden tried to free up a lot of money for climate work, and so far, Senator Joe Manchin has prevented him from doing so. But some unexpected things happened too, such as December tornadoes and windstorms, which had devastated parts of the country and which are increasingly linked to warming. The most unexpected event by far, though, the thing that was truly off the charts, came in June. Toward the end of the month, torrential rains across China created a lot of atmospheric moisture, with the jet stream sucked out over the Pacific. Meanwhile, the remnants of a heat wave in the American Southwest moved north. The two weather events met over the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada, forming a giant dome of high pressure that diverted moisture to both the north and the south. Gradually, over a period of several days, the core of the high-pressure area freed itself of clouds, allowing the sun's rays to blast down during the days immediately after the solstice. The result was the most remarkable heat wave in recorded history. On Sunday, June 27th, Canada broke its all-time heat record of 113 degrees Fahrenheit, when the temperature reached nearly 116 degrees in Lytton, a community of around 250 residents on the Fraser River in southern British Columbia. The next day, that record was broken again in Lytton when the temperature hit 118 degrees. On Tuesday, it was smashed again when the temperature in the town soared to 121 degrees. On Wednesday, Lytton, now parched dry, burned to the ground in a wildfire. Only a few buildings were left standing. Breaking a long-standing record is hard. Canada's old high-temperature record dated to 1937. Surpassing it by 8 degrees is, in theory, statistically impossible. It was hotter in Canada that day than on any day ever recorded in Florida or in Europe or in South America. There has never been a national heat record in a country with an extensive period of recording and a multitude of observation sites that was beaten by 7 degrees to 8 degrees Fahrenheit, the weather historian Christopher C. Burt said. Records of almost equally incredible magnitude came in from across the region. Quileute, Washington, broke its all-time record high by 11 degrees at 110 degrees Fahrenheit, even though the town is just 3 miles from the Pacific. It was over 103 at Fort Smith in the Northwest Territories, beating an 80-year-old record. According to Maximiliano Herrera, a weather historian who maintains a website devoted to unprecedented temperatures, the number of all times records beaten by more than 5 degrees centigrade in this heat wave is greater than all cases worldwide together in the past 85 years. Jeff Masters and Bob Henson, meteorologists who blog for a Yale climate website, wrote, "Never in the century-plus history of world weather observation have so many all-time heat records fallen by such a large margin." The reason, of course, is the climate crisis. Within days, researchers had demonstrated with the modeling techniques of the new attribution science that global warming had made such a heat wave 150 times more likely. Essentially, this couldn't have happened on the Earth we used to know. James Hansen, the planet's most important climatologist, put it this way when I talked to him last month. "We've been expecting extreme events, but what happened in Canada was unusually extreme." The reason all this is so frightening is that it suggests fundamental parts of the way that the planet works have begun to shift, allowing for physical phenomena we've never seen before. It suggests, that is, that the predictions provided by global climate models, which are frightening enough, may be too optimistic. The impossible heat in that week seems to be connected with the increasingly unstable operation of the jet stream, which in turn seems to be connected with the rapid melt of the Arctic Ocean. As the temperature difference between the equator and the pole lessens, the jet stream seems to get stuck in odd positions. Meanwhile, a flood of fresh water from that same melting Arctic seems to be disrupting the Gulf Stream. A new study, which was conducted by European scientists and released a few months before the heat dome appeared, strengthened the theory that the immense ocean current, which is 100 times the flow of the Amazon, and which, like the jet stream, distributes heat poleward, had slowed by roughly 15% since 1950. We're breaking really big things. Scientists have done a good job of calculating how much the world will warm as we increase the amount of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere. They're pretty confident that, having raised the temperature more than a degree Celsius already, we're on our way to a planet that will be, on average, 3 degrees warmer. That's if we keep on our current track. The scientists are hopeful that, if we take actions more dramatic than those promised at Glasgow, we might hold the average increase below 2 degrees. But researchers are not as confident, especially since the June heat wave, that we really understand how much damage those global averages represent. Scientists are inherently conservative in their predictions. The world is clearly more fragile than the models have led us to believe. And that's what was terrifying about 2021. Next, again from the 2021 Year in Review by the New Yorker magazine, The Best Jokes of 2021 by Ian Crouch. On July 27th, TMZ reported that the comedian and actor Bob Odenkirk had collapsed on the set of Better Call Saul, which was filming its final season and had been rushed to the hospital. For most of the next day, there was a silence about his condition, leaving an ardent community on Twitter to enact a kind of vigil. Fellow comedians sharing memories, fans sharing favorite clips, and more people than anyone might have expected hoping together for the best. During those unnerving hours, it seemed possible that the last example we might ever get of Odenkirk's brilliant performance style, warm, absorbing, kind of grimy, was a short bit from the second season of the sketch show I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson, which had premiered earlier that month. In the scene, titled Dinner Wink, a father convinces Odenkirk, who plays the man at the next table, to go along with a story he's telling his daughter about how ice cream stores close when it's cold out. After indulging this white lie, Odenkirk's character, in a mixture of pathos, desperation, and gleeful conniving, compels the father to agree to his increasingly strange claims that he owns every kind of classic car, 3 of the same model in some cases, triples his best, that he has a dying wife, that he doesn't live in a hotel. If these aren't true, he reminds the father, then neither is the part about ice cream. Like so many of Odenkirk's characters, this man is a BSer whose twisted frailty reveals some tragic human truth. Thankfully, the scene wasn't a farewell. On the 28th, Odenkirk's son, Nate, had good news to share, tweeting, "He's going to be okay." In what's been another rough year, it was a collective moment of relief. Here were some other moments that brought relief, or at least a diversion, some bafflement, or a rueful chuckle in 2021. 1. Flags of Our Forefathers. In his latest special, Imperfect Messenger, the comedian and Daily Show correspondent Roy Wood Jr. jokes about the residue of racism that clings to modern phrases and objects, implied or faintly felt, though not expressed outright. "You ever been somewhere and there's too many American flags?" he asked. "It just feels..." He bounces back and forth a little, rubbing the fingers of his left hand with his thumb, like, how many American flags equals one Confederate flag? 2. The Farce of Facebook. Facebook is a scourge, but it at least throws off sparks of humor as it grinds us all down. Take the preposterous video presentation that Mark Zuckerberg hosted in October to announce the company's rebrand as Meta. With waxen skin and glazed eyes, clothed in a signature dark long-sleeve shirt and jeans, Zuckerberg seems little more human than the replicant avatar he uses to demonstrate immersive 3D experiences, Kyle Chaika wrote of the CEO's affect. Earlier that month, Facebook crashed for hours, giving the world a glimpse of life without it. Many people made jokes. A favorite was by the writer Ben Schwartz, who pointed back to Facebook's origins as Face Mash, a Harvard hot or not clone. Mark Zuckerberg has concluded his research into rating every woman on Earth and has now shut down Facebook, Schwartz wrote. Thank you for all your cooperation. 3. Let's go, Brandon. A good example of how a legitimately funny circumstance can be made painfully unfunny in the hands of painfully unfunny people. This fall, after the stock car driver Brandon Brown won a race at the Talladega Super Speedway in Alabama, his post-race interview was momentarily drowned out by members of the crowd chanting, F. Joe Biden. The interviewer, perhaps mishearing or maybe attempting a bit of live TV dubbing jiu-jitsu, noted that they were saying, "Let's go, Brandon." It was a real-life Boo Earns or Find a Stranger in the Alps moment. The phrase quickly became a meme on the right and then just as quickly was grabbed by the professional grievance class of tweeting politicians. See Ted Cruz, Lauren Boebert, et al., who have never met a joke they couldn't spoil. 4. California Dreamin'. The half-hour series Reservation Dogs, about a group of young people scraping by on a Native American reservation in Oklahoma, begins as a plain homage to Quentin Tarantino, but quickly spins out in several curious, hilarious directions. The four kids who make up the series wannabe gang are saving money to split for California. When one of them, Willie Jack, played in a breakout performance by Paulina Alexis, is asked by her father why she wants to go. The answer is obvious. Duh, it's got the best doctors. Snoop Dogg's from there. Dr. Dre. S-word, even F and Dr. Phil. 5. Norm MacDonald considers time. MacDonald died of leukemia in September at the age of 61. It was a shock. He'd been diagnosed with the disease nearly a decade earlier, but he hadn't talked about it publicly. Fortunately, there were hours of clips online to provide consolation, including his final Letterman appearance in 2015. In his deadpan, discursive, and slightly out-of-time manner, he noted how, in bygone days, a man might have sat for a single photographic portrait in his life. A farmer, say, looking stoically and a little impatiently into the lens, eager to return to his work. The scarcity of that single picture made it worth saving. But what about our daily snaps? 50 years from now, MacDonald ventured, people will be going like, "Hey, you want to see 100,000 pictures of my great-grandfather?" 6. Dips for Dinner. Selena Gomez is the vital comedic ingredient of Hulu's Only Murders in the Building, a satire of two crime podcasts and Upper West Side Moors that also stars Steve Martin and Martin Short. But for the series' silliest bit and finest earworm, the honors go to Short, who plays a washed-up Broadway director named Oliver Putnam. In a brief musical number, Putnam introduces his contender for the next fad diet. Keto? Intermittent fasting? Why not simply get all your calories in the form of dips? Dips for dinner, dips for dinner, I'm a nut for dips, he sings. Later, he explains, I bet I have not had a regular entree for years. Granted, I've lost 14 pounds and a significant amount of hair, but it's totally worth it. 7. The Uncanny Valley of Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso is funny and charming, but it turns out that Brett Goldstein, who plays the gruff retired footballer Roy Kent, is very funny and very charming. During an appearance on Jimmy Kimmel Live, Goldstein told the story of how he'd gone from a writer on the show to one of its stars by emailing an unsolicited audition tape to the producers. He also addressed the odd feeling, common among Ted Lasso viewers, that his character resembles a computer-generated image. When I found out I was CGI, it was quite disconcerting, Goldstein said, because I've seen a lot of sci-fi films and I started to be like, maybe I am, because they'd implant memories to make me think I wasn't. Whether he's real or not, Goldstein was the year's best late-night guest. 8. New York City goes to the polls. One-party towns are probably bad for democracy, but they're good for a laugh. Consider this year's New York City mayoral race, whose foregone Democratic conclusion left a void in the Republican primary, which was filled by the gadfly guardian angel Curtis Sliwa. In the race's final days, the Democrat Eric Adams was caught driving on the sidewalk. Sliwa, meanwhile, was hit by a taxi, showed up to the polls carrying a cat named Gizmo, which was forced to remain outside, got into a fight about his jacket with election officials, and then had his ballot jam in the machine when he tried to vote. New York is back, baby. 9. Rosebud Baker on abortion. As abortion rights were imperiled and curtailed this year, the Supreme Court is currently considering whether to overturn Roe v. Wade. Comedians responded in a variety of styles. On Saturday Night Live, Cecily Strong dressed as Goober the Clown to speak about the life-changing abortion she had before her 23rd birthday. And the comedian Rosebud Baker, in her debut special Whiskey Fists, combined a precise and calculated setup with a caustically confessional style to deliver one of the most startling jokes of the year. I'm thinking about having kids, because I'm pregnant. Just kidding. I was when I wrote that joke. Only one of those got delivered. 10. The Aghast Supper. For years, The Onion's political cartoonist, Stan Kelly, a fictional mustachioed loon who springs from the mind of the more reasonable Ward Sutton, has been pitted in an arms race with reality, staking out ever more ludicrous right-wing culture war positions. In January, he seemed to create an unsurpassable expression of nonsense, Jesus Christ and his followers being denied service at Hooters because of COVID restrictions, leaving the apostles in tears, an American Eagle dead on the floor, and Lady Liberty sobbing in the parking lot. Yet, as the year draws to a close, are we sure this is the most outrageous thing that someone has said about Jesus and the coronavirus? This last story of 2021 is dedicated to my father, Bill Mercer, who will turn 96 in 2022. From the personal history section of the February 24, 1992 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Early Innings, Boyhood Memories of Baseball, by Roger Angel. There are more holes than fabric in my earliest baseball recollections. My father began taking me and my older sister to games at some point in the latter 20s, but no first ever view of Babe Ruth or of the Green Barn or the Polo Grounds remains in mind. We must have attended with some regularity because I'm sure I saw the Babe and Lou Gehrig hit back-to-back home runs on more than one occasion. Mel Ott's stumpy cowtail swing is still before me, and so are Gehrig's thick calves and Ruth's debutante ankles. Baseball caps were different back then, smaller and flatter than today's constructions, more like the workman's caps that one saw on every street. Some of the visiting players, the Cardinals, for instance, wore their caps cheerfully askew or tipped back on their heads, but never the Yankees. Gloves were much smaller, too, and the outfielders left theirs on the grass in the shallow parts of the field when their side came in to bat. I wondered why a batted ball wouldn't strike them on the fly or on the bounce someday, but it never happened. John McGraw, for one, wouldn't have permitted such a thing. He was managing the Giants with his arms folded across his vest. He wore a suit some days and a uniform on others, and kept his tough, thick chin aimed at the umpires. I would look for him, along with Ott and Bill Terry and Travis Jackson, the minute we arrived at our seats in the Polo Grounds. Everything about the Polo Grounds was special, right down to the looped iron chains that separated each sector of box seats from its neighbor, and could burn your arm on a summer afternoon if you weren't careful. Far along each outfield wall, a sloping mini-roof projected outward, imparting a thin wedge of shadow for the bullpen crew sitting there. They looked like cows sheltering beside a pasture shed in August. Across the river, the view when you arrived was different but equally delectable, a panorama of svelte infield and steep, filigree-topped inner battlements that was offered and then snatched away as one straw seat IRT train rumbled into the elevated station at 161st Street. If the Polo Grounds felt pastoral, Yankee Stadium was metropole, the big city personified. For some reason, we always walked around it along the right field side, never the other way. And each time I would wonder about the oddly arrayed ticket kiosks that stood off at such a distance from the gates. Something about security, I decided. One of these days, they'll demand to see passports there. Inside, up the pleasing ramps, I would stop and bend over, peering through the horizontal slot between the dark, overhanging mezzanine and the descending sweep of grandstand seats, which led one's entranced eye to the sunlit green of the field and the players on it. Then I'd look for the babe. The first Yankee manager I can remember in residence was Bob Schalke, which means 1930. I was 9 years old. Sports were different in my youth, a series of events to look forward to and then to turn over in memory, rather than a huge, omnipresent industry with its own economics and politics and crushing public relations. How it felt to be a young baseball fan in the 30s can be appreciated only if I can bring back this lighter and fresher atmosphere. Attending a game meant a lot, to adults as well as to a boy, because it was the only way you could encounter athletes and watch what they did. There was no television, no instant replay, no evening highlights. We saw the players' faces in newspaper photographs or in the pages of baseball, an engrossing monthly with an invariable red cover to which I subscribed, and here and there in an advertisement. I think Lou Gehrig plugged Fleischmann's yeast, a health remedy said to be good for the complexion. We never heard athletes' voices or became aware of their image. Bo Jackson and Joe Montana and Michael Jordan were light years away. Baseball by radio was a rarity, confined for the most part to the World Series. The three New York teams, in fact, banned radio coverage of their regular season games between 1934 and 38, on the theory that daily broadcasts would damage attendance. Following baseball always required a visit to the player's place of business, and once there, you watched them with attention, undistracted by diamond vision or rock music or game promotions. Seeing the players in action on the field, always at a little distance, gave them a heroic tinge. The only player I can remember encountering on the street one day on the West Side was the Babe, in retirement by then, swathed in his familiar camel hair coat with matching cap. When I began writing this brief memoir, I was surprised to find how often its trail circled back to my father. If I continue now with his baseball story instead of my own, it's because the two are so different, yet feel intertwined and continuous. He was born in 1889 and lost his father at the age of 8 in a maritime disaster. He had no brothers, and I think he concluded early on that it was incumbent on him to learn and excel at every sport, all on his own. He was not a great natural athlete, but his spirit made him a tough adversary. My Oedipal struggles with him on the tennis court went on almost into my 30s, but we stayed cheerful. Somewhere along the line, a family doctor took me aside and said, "Don't try to keep up with him. Nobody's ever going to do that." Baseball meant a great deal to my father, and he was lucky enough to grow up in a time when there were diamonds and pickup nines in every hamlet in America. He played first base and pitched, and in his late teens joined a village team, the Tamworth Tigers, that played in the White Mountain Valleys of New Hampshire, where he and his mother and sister went on their vacations. Many years after this, on a car trip when he was in his 70s, my father found himself near the mountains he knew so well and made a swing over to Chokura and Tamworth to check out the scenes of his youth. He found the Remick Brothers General Store still in business, and then when he went in, the man at the counter behind the postcards in the little birch bark canoes was Wadsworth Remick, who had played with him on the Tigers long ago. Waddy Remick. There were no signs of recognition, however, and my old man, perhaps uncomfortable in the role of visiting big city slicker, didn't press the matter. He bought a pack of gum or something and was just going out the door when he heard, "Played any first base lately, Ernest?" I think people gave up with reluctance in older days. My father sailed through Harvard in 3 years, making Phi Beta Kappa, but he didn't make the varsity in baseball and had to settle for playing on a class team. I think my very first recollection of him, I was a small child, is of standing beside him in a little downstairs bathroom of our summer place while he washed dirt off his face and arms after a ball game. Years passed. In the summer of 1937, I worked on a small combined ranch and farm in northern Missouri, owned by a relative who raised purebred white-faced Hereford. I drove cattle to their waterholes on horseback, cleaned chicken coops, and shot marauding evening jackrabbits in the vegetable garden. It was a drought year, and the temperature would go well over 100 degrees every afternoon. White dust lay on the trees. I was 16. Both the Giants and the Yankees were rushing toward another pennant in New York. It was the DiMaggio, Heinrich, Rolf, Crosetti Yankees by now. But I had a hard time finding news of them in the austere, photoless columns of the Kansas City Star. All I could pick up on the radio was Frank Locks doing Cardinal games over KMOX. My father arrived for a visit and soon discovered that there would be a local ball game the next Sunday with some of the hands on the ranch representing our nearby town. Somehow he cajoled his way onto the team. He was close to 50, but looked much younger. He played first base and got a single in a losing cause. Late in the game, I was sent up to pinch hit for somebody. The pitcher, a large and unpleasant-looking young man, must have felt distaste at the sight of a scared 16-year-old dude standing in, because he dismissed me with two fiery fastballs and then a curve that I waved at without hope, without a chance. I sat down again. My father said nothing at the time, but later on in the day, perhaps riding back to supper, he murmured, "What'd he throw you? Two hard ones and a hook?" I nodded, my ears burning. There was a pause, and Father said, "The curveball away can be very tough." It was late afternoon, but the view from my side of the car suddenly grew brighter. It's hard to hear stories like this now without an accompanying inner smirk. We are wary of sentiment and obsessively knowing, and we feel obliged to put a spin of psychology or economic determinism or bored contempt on all clear-color memories. I suppose somehow someone could say that my father was a privileged wasp who was able to pursue some adolescent rustic yearnings far too late in life. But that would miss the point. My father was knowing, too. He was a New York sophisticate who spurned cynicism. He had only limited financial success as a Wall Street lawyer, but that work allowed him to put in great amounts of time with the American Civil Liberties Union, which he served as a long-term chairman of its national board. Most of his life, I heard him talk about the latest issues or cases involving censorship, Jim Crow laws, voting rights, freedom of speech, racial and sexual discrimination, and threats to the Constitution. These struggles continue to this day, God knows. But the difference back then was that men and women like my father's always sounded as if such battles would be won in the end. The news was always harsh and fresh threats to freedom immediate, but every problem was capable of a solution somewhere down the line. We don't hold such ideas anymore, about our freedoms or about anything else. My father looked on baseball the same way. He would never be a big league player or even a college player, but whenever he found a game, he jumped at the chance to play and to win. If this sounds like a romantic or foolish impulse to us today, it is because most of American life, including baseball, no longer feels feasible. We know everything about the game now, thanks to instant replay and computerized stats, and what we seem to have concluded is that almost none of us are good enough to play it. Thanks to television and sports journalism, we also know everything about the skills and financial worth and private lives of the enormous young men we have hired to play baseball for us. But we don't seem to know how to keep their salaries or their personalities within human proportions. We don't like them as much as we once did. And we don't like ourselves as much either. Baseball becomes feasible from time to time, not much more. And we fans must make prodigious efforts to rearrange our profoundly ironic contemporary psyches in order to allow its old pleasures to reach us. My father wasn't naive. He was lucky. One more thing. American men don't think about baseball as much as they used to. But such thoughts once went deep. In my middle 30s, I still followed the Yankees and the Giants in the standings, but my own playing days were long forgotten. I had not yet tried writing about the sport. I was living in the suburbs, and one night I had a vivid dream, in which I arose from my bed. It was almost a movie dream. Went downstairs and walked outdoors in the dark. I continued down our little patch of lawn and crossed the tiny bridge at the foot of our property, and there, within a tangle of underbrush, discovered a single gravestone. I leaned forward. I absolutely guarantee all this, and found my own name inscribed there, and below it, the dates of my birth and of the present year, the dream time, 1920-1955. The dream scared me, needless to say, but providentially, I was making periodic visits to a shrink at the time. I took the dream to our next session like a trophy, but having recounted it, had no idea what it might mean. "What does it suggest to you?" the goodly man said in a predictable fashion. "It's sort of like those monuments out by the flagpole in deep center field at the stadium," I said. Then I stopped and cried. Oh, because of course it had suddenly come clear. My dreams of becoming a major league ball player had died at last. That's it for The New Yorker for 2021. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The readings are available as podcasts at our reading service, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening. This is Evan Mercer. Happy New Year, everybody.